Welcome to The Parrot Unbound. This is Grace, the Library and Community Relations page. You're about to hear Lee Webster's Going Out Green presentation. This program took place on February 15th and was co-sponsored by Portsmouth Public Library, New Hampshire Funeral Resources, Education and Advocacy, the Hospice Help Foundation, and Seacoast Permaculture. Happy listening.
My name is Marcia Fillion. I'm the Executive Director of Hospice Help Foundation. We help hospice patients who are struggling with poverty in their final days, and we fund items that are essential to their well-being so that they can live each day to the fullest. And these are things like rent and heating and electricity. But the other thing that we love to do is bring people together to talk about death and dying. And that's why we're so happy to have you all join us today. We have partnered up with Lee Webster for New Hampshire Funeral Resources, Education and Advocacy. I'm really thrilled to have had her make the trek all the way down here. And also Amy Antonucci, who is with Seacoast Permaculture Group. And she will be talking in just a second about their involvement in this talk. But I just wanted to very quickly say that what we find with our death cafes that we have in this very room on a quarterly basis is that people who are thoughtful about their mortality and their imminent demise, they find it much easier to focus on the things that matter in life. And so we hope that you come away with this as being a life-affirming experience, just as our death cafes. Our next death cafe will be March 21st in this room. But without further ado, Amy, thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Antonucci with Seacoast Permaculture. Who here is here because you found out about this through Seacoast Permaculture? A bunch of you. Yeah, great. I will say that when we first started bringing Lee here about 5 or 6 years ago, this is about the fifth of these we've done, I believe we had 12 people. Every time we do it, we have a larger group, so it's really exciting to see people's interest in this grow, including, anyone see this? Green dying issue of Yes Magazine, and of course, those of you who watch Adam Ruins Everything, you've seen his green burial one? Got to check that out. Anyway, so this is clearly something that people are really interested in. Let me, and we're really glad that you are too, and that you're here to learn more. I'll tell you a tiny bit about Seacoast Permaculture. We're a group that works in this area on regenerative and sustainable solutions to many different problems. A lot of what we do is around things like growing food and building green and transportation and all the way to burying green. So we try to cover a lot of things. We have about 50 programs a year, and we'd love to have you join us at any and all of them. Again, thanks to the Portsmouth Public Library and to the Hospice Help Foundation for helping to support the program. And we are so happy to once again have Lee Webster here. She is the director of the New Hampshire Funeral Resources Education and Advocacy Group. She is the Emeritus President. Help me out. That. President of the National Home Funeral Alliance, and also of the Board of Directors and Educational Consultant and Development for the Green Burial Council. She is a writer, including being in this. She wrote something in here. She is a researcher, a hospice volunteer, home funeral guide, conservationist, and frequent speaker. And we are always thrilled to have her because she really makes this topic way more engaging and even entertaining than we really thought was possible. So let's welcome her to entertain us. Thank you.
Now the pressure's on.
So thank you very much, and thanks everybody for coming out on a Saturday afternoon in February.
One quick correction, I'm actually on my second round with the Green Burial Council as the president of the education group, and soon to let that go again. And I want to just suggest to you that part of the reason that you're hearing more and more about green burial and about home funerals and about all of the things that you're catching on your Facebook feeds and has everything to do with these nonprofit organizations gaining strength and working shoulder to shoulder to try and get all of this work out. So take a look at the websites of all of these organizations we have RAC cards for here, and you'll see there's a lot of cross-referencing, also with the Funeral Consumers Alliance, and they're about 30 years strong. So there are a lot of resources out there that are people mistapping, and it's really important to go to those because they're going to find your most accurate source there. First things first. One of the biggest things we talk about with New Hampshire Free is that the work that we do has to do with helping people make informed decisions. We're not trying to steer anyone away from the funeral industry, from funeral directors, or anything like that. Please don't misconstrue anything that I say as saying we want to get rid of that and forge a whole new path. We're looking at finding end-of-life options that really meet our individual goals, and there are a lot of ways to achieve that. Some of the things that we have to be paying attention to, though, the major things are the legal requirements, so we're going to go over quite a bit of that. We're going to talk about cost factors. That seems to be a driving force for a lot of people. They'll make decisions that they don't want to make because they don't want to spend the money. We have solutions for that. Environmental considerations are huge, and you'll notice that I'm really focusing on that significantly here today. The other is cultural and spiritual decisions that we all have family traditions, so we don't want to give those up. We just need to find a way to sort of morph those into something that has great meaning to us now. And bringing back meaning that we may have lost as we, live in this very, movable culture. So one of the other things I like to do really quickly is go through some funeral facts. I can't tell you how many times I've sat in a room with people who should know better, who, when I say something like next of kin has full custody and control of the body, it's not illegal for you to be with a dead body. There are no funeral police who are going to come and arrest you for being with your loved one, and I've had people say, oh, that's not true. People who should know better. So we're gonna go through them, and that's the first one. This is sort of the basis for everything you're gonna learn about home funerals. Funeral directors themselves, we tend to, and this is very intentional, we tend to look at funeral directors as though they were doctors or lawyers. Well, they are licensed, but they aren't licensed in medicine or the law. So it's important to understand that they are a partner for you, they're a professional that you hire, but they are not someone that you absolutely have to hire. There are no funeral police. Nobody is, when someone dies, they may die in your home, there's nobody keeping a stopwatch on what's going on here. You don't have to call anyone there. They become your responsibility. And the privilege and responsibility of caring for our own dead is something we're trying to bring back, even if we still hire a funeral professional. Here's another one that I get a lot, where I tell people embalming is not required by law. No, you don't need to. It tends to be a policy in funeral homes that they prefer not to have a body be unembalmed when there's a viewing, but there is no legal requirement to do this. Cooling the body is sufficient, as it always has been from the beginning of time. So that's another major thing to let go of. Vaults. Everybody know that there's sort of the typical cemetery, particularly municipal cemeteries, have bylaws that require concrete or plastic or other type of material, fiberglass, and there's all kinds of stuff that people use all over the country. And that goes around the casket. And the thing is that those are not required by law either. Those are decisions that were made by individual cemeteries. And we're going to talk about how that got it into being, but they're not required. Home burials are legal in New Hampshire, and we're going to go over that as well. So this is sort of five basic things. Once we get this out of our our worry basket, we can keep on going. So here's a couple people. You might know one and perhaps not the other. These were the folks who changed funerals for us and the way that we do funerals in America. And the first one you recognize, this is Abe Lincoln on his way back home after he was assassinated on the train. It took 2 weeks and five separate embalmings with zinc and arsenic and all kinds of great things to keep him as in good enough shape to make the trip and have people see him. He had been a longtime proponent of embalming. He actually instituted what's called General Rule 39 of the Civil War, of the War Department, and that meant that only people who were recognized by the government could do embalming on the field, on the battlefield. And that was sort of the beginning of the idea of a profession. He also had his son Willie, when Willie died, he had him embalmed. and when Abraham Lincoln died and was subsequently embalmed by Mary, they dug up Willie and sent him on the train too. A lot of people don't know that. Also, the first person who died in the Civil War, he made sure that he was embalmed. And this is very crude stuff, but it got people started. It's how the embalming piece got started. The guy on the right, his name is Wilbert Haas, German descendant, American concrete magnate in about the 1920s. In 1930, Wilbert took a trip to see Tutankhamun's tomb. And he had this light bulb moment about how he could solve all kinds of problems that people were concerned about now. Now that they had gotten rid of miasma theory, we're thinking about germ theory, people were dying in hospitals rather than at home from farming accidents and more industrial accidents. All of these things were starting to create a whole different culture around death and the way that we handle death. And with it came some really interesting fears. One of them was ghouls. They were building these vaults to go around caskets to keep people safe from the ghouls. At the same time, we were embalming bodies in order to preserve them and keep them, you know, safe for eternity was the promise at the time. It was mostly done with this particular phrase in mind, in the interest of public health and safety, that for some reason, you know, we needed to encase these bodies and encase them again because we're afraid of them. With germ theory suddenly becoming a thing, that suddenly we realized how people got sick, we just conflated that with the idea that dead bodies must be dangerous, infectious, contagious, all these different words that are different but meant the same thing to the American public. So what we have come to after many, many years of this particular myth, you know, taking hold, is the understanding that embalming is a cosmetic procedure. It does have preservative qualities for a very short period of time, but it just doesn't protect us from diseases of any kind. That's not what it's for. And the World Health Organization, Center for Disease Control, all of these organizations have statements similar to what you see here, that essentially, you know, dead bodies are not innately dangerous any more than they were prior to the Civil War when everyone took care of their loved one in their home on their, you know, family table. Just, it still isn't a thing, okay? And if you're worried about Ebola, that's not a case we're going to worry about keeping at home. This is kind of the basis for understanding why it's safe for us to take care of our loved ones. When you think about it, if you've had someone in your life who is a hospice patient who is at home, they aren't any more dangerous after they've stopped breathing than they were before. In fact, they're less dangerous in many cases. I'd much rather be with a dead person with y'all sneezing today. Cost is a big concern for people, and there's a lot of conflicting information out there, but I think that the numbers to keep in mind are these. We're really looking at between $11,000 and $12,000 for a full funeral, the viewing and the burial, not necessarily having to do with casket and so on. It doesn't include those prices, so you're going to add that. You would add the actual burial plot and opening and closing fees and stuff, so it can get higher than this, but this is sort of the average. And here in New Hampshire, we fit that average pretty well. That's really full boat. There's a company called Service Corporation International, and there are others like it, conglomerates you may have heard of, SCI, other ones. These are corporations that over the last few years have been buying up mom and pop funeral homes that have been in your family for generations. They often will leave the name the same so that you don't know the difference, and they'll often have hire the people who have owned it to run it for them. So it's pretty seamless. The only thing that really, really changes is the price. Is an average of 34 to 38% higher for SCI-owned funeral homes than the guy down the street, which is, again, part of being an informed consumer. You may still choose to go with that funeral director. You just need to be aware that you're going to find different pricing no matter where you go. This is one of the things to look for. The average for direct cremation, and direct cremation basically means, you know, someone dies, someone comes, picks up the body, takes it to the crematory, takes care of the paperwork and so on for you, all the filing and everything, and then the body, bone matter is then returned to the family. And that's an, kind of an average price. We're a little bit less here in the state of New Hampshire, and you can find funeral homes with their own crematories that will do this for way less than that, even under $1,000. The thing to know is that the cremation itself costs somewhere around $400 for the actual act of cremating the body. So everything else that you're paying for, all those other things that I mentioned. And this is important to note because there aren't many of them, but we do have one near us in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. We have a nonprofit crematory that charges $400 if you do your own driving. That's all you pay. So it's good to know that that's an option. A couple more quick things here. A lot of people are questioning, you're still questioning the cost of funeral homes. Part of the reason for this is that there are 2.5 times more of them in the U.S. than we have bodies, you know, to pay for. It's this basic economic supply and demand issue, right? Now, as the silver tsunami kicks up here in the next few years and we have all the baby boomers going, this is probably going to even out a little bit more and we're going to be happy that these funeral homes survived. But it's not easy for them because, you know, everybody goes toward direct cremation, which is about 50% nationally right now. In some places, like here in New Hampshire, Vermont, we're up in the 80% in a lot of counties. But you can see why they're struggling to stay in business and why they have to keep raising prices, because they need to be able to stay, you know, keep their lights on. It's important to understand that funeral directors actually make less than the average third grade teacher in the United States, your average funeral director in their mom and pop organization. So no demonizing funeral directors here. It's just a question of which things you want to purchase. And stop looking at it as though, you know, you have to do whatever, you know, you thought you had to do. So we're going to bust some more of those myths with a whole another area. Home funerals. Has anybody here cared for their own loved one after they died in their home? Yeah. Wonderful. See, but it used to be everybody, right? Everyone took care of their loved one in their home. It's a pretty simple process when someone dies. We bathe them. And we can dress the body ourselves. We can put the body in a shroud or a casket or whatever we might have. We can file the death certificate ourselves, and I'm going to tell you how to go about doing that. You get the permit, the transport permit is the burial permit, and we'll talk about how you get that. But basically, once you have that, it's kind of like your FedEx ticket, and it goes everywhere the body goes, and you can go anywhere you want. You can make your own disposition arrangements. So the cemetery, you can call the crematory. Some may say that they won't accept without the help of a funeral director, but you do have the right to make those arrangements yourself. And transporting the body, I know we've learned that you can fit a lovely alternate container right in the back of a Prius. So it just means everybody rides on the left, but everybody gets there. When my mom died a few years ago, my sister was up from Virginia with me, and we had bathed my mom, and we'd taken care of her. We'd gotten the medical examiner to come to the house, which was a first. That had never happened in New Hampshire. And when it was time, we loaded mom into the back of the van, and we just listened to great music that she would have loved all the way up to the crematory. And that was an experience that neither of us will ever forget. There's more to the experience than just what looks like very static, oh, you do this, then you do this, then you do this. There's a whole lot of things that are happening in the middle of this, and it might take a few hours, and it might take a few days, and it might be very funny, and it might be heart-wrenching, and it might be everything all together, but it's an experience that everyone feels complete about when they're done. I hear people say it all the time, particularly you men folk, who tend not like to go in the door way when it comes to bathing and so on. I hear often from men who are part of the process in the end that they were reluctant, but once everybody else cleared out, you know, 2 a.m, they were happy to go down and sit with mom or whoever it might be. And then the next thing you hear from them is, I'd never do it any other way. And they're telling their buds at Rotary all about it. Because I know I go to Rotary and they tell me everything I need to know about this. The biggest things about home funeral, one of the biggest things is that it gives everyone who's there a chance to feel useful. And I can't stress this enough. Part of the disconnect that we feel about death at this point has to do with the fact that we haven't been routinely involved in the processes that go around, through it and around it. And one of the most, one of the biggest things that's happened to us is that we've lost our sense of feeling needed during this time. When we've lost someone, part of the grieving process is we're trying to reconnect all of the pieces together, right? A friend of mine said at one time that the purpose of home funerals is to mend the tear in the fabric of the community that occurs when someone dies. And that's what we're doing when we're doing all these activities, and we're doing them together. So that piece, and particularly children really need to feel involved and connected. And I always use the example of the dog. I have a grandson who was so thrilled when my mom was there. His job was to go walk the dog. Well, I mean, there wasn't a person who came in the house that didn't hear about his dog walking capability. Very important stuff. It also strengthens community itself as well as family ties. Sometimes this is a time when relatives who haven't gotten along so well might actually smooth a few things over. It could go the other way too, so don't bank on that. It also is pretty affordable. It really costs next to nothing to, you use what you have in your home. You bathe with soap. One of the things I love about the bathing process is you don't have to, you don't have to do everything. But sometimes just bathing the hands, having people come in, I always look at people and say, look, you know how to operate a washcloth. I think you can do this. And we'll use scents that the person might, you'd be associated with. So you're not walking into a place where there's a faint smell of something else that wasn't, you don't associate. Everybody walked in. My mom was a Jean Nate user. A lot of you ladies will remember the yellow puff. And my brother walked in and he says, oh my gosh, it's mom. It's like he hadn't really figured it out yet, right? It takes time to absorb this idea. And the smell is very strong, makes a difference. And as I say, you want to hire professionals as needed. There's no reason not to call a funeral director for any of the above, because they'll help you. That's their job. They want to help families do these things. One funeral director said to me early on when I started this work, he said, it's no problem for us. Call us when you need us. And no, keep your loved one home. Call us when you're ready. So they like to sleep at night too. They don't need to come out at 2 o'clock in the morning during an ice storm to pick up somebody who's just going to be in a cool room, which you could have done at home. So who actually owns the dead? I talked about how the next of kin has the right to custody and control. This is the way that the law actually lays it out in New Hampshire. And this is important because it's the spouse or a designated agent. And you may have seen on the table there something called designation of agent for after death arrangements. You don't need this unless you're having someone other than a family member taking care of your final disposition arrangements. That would be if you were estranged from family, or if you had someone who lives in Bangkok and they're not going to get home in time to take care of things, and you'd rather have your neighbor or your best friend or someone else help with this. That's when you would need to have this completed and in with the rest of your advance directives. So don't think you have to have that one. But as you can see, it kind of goes, it just goes from the spouse or that designated agent or down to the kids, to the parents, to the grandparents, to the this, and everything kind of like all out there. The beauty of it is at the very far end of this list, there's also a little note that says that your ex can never make your funeral directions. A lot of people are happy about that. Here's another piece that is important to put into your advance directives, right? How many of you have your advance directives already? How many of you have them in the freezer? All right, you got a job when you get home. Got to get it done, got to get it in the freezer. And the reason you do that is that if the house burns down, chances are good it's still going to be there. But more importantly, when you tell people you put your stuff in the in the freezer, they'll remember where it is instead of that thing we did for 10 years with my father-in-law, who died at 102, by the way. Yeah, he. Every time we went to see him for years and years and years, it was like, okay, let me show you where everything is again. You know, so freezer, one time would have done it. Anyway, this is a great piece, the information worksheet. This is everything that is on a death certificate, so that if you want to file the death certificate yourself, here's all your info. And you've done it, you're not under stress, you've already got it ready, and you've figured out, you know, what the veteran's number was, or you know, somebody's middle name or whatever that can't come to you otherwise. Get this done. Here it is, the dreaded paperwork. My friend Chuck Lakin from up in Waterville, Maine, calls it the dreaded paperwork. I always like to give him credit. Is anybody here from Maine as well? Excellent. You want to go to the website lastthings.net, and you'll run into Chuck, who many of you probably already have run into. And that'll give you specific information about Maine. It's not a lot different from New Hampshire, but it's good to have that. So the first thing you're going to do when someone dies, if you're going to handle the paperwork yourself, we'll rip through this. You're going to get that death certificate. It will be initiated by the medical person in charge, whether that's a hospice nurse or the attending physician in the hospital. It could be the medical examiner if there was a reason to have called in a medical examiner. And the reason you call in a medical examiner is to determine the cause of death. So if there was a reason to bring that person in, they'll initiate that paperwork. And instead of handing it to the funeral director, if you were to hire them, they simply hand it to you, acting as your own funeral director. So that's where it starts. You don't have to go anywhere to get forms and files and all that kind of thing. They hand it right to you. There are two parts to it. The first part is the medical part, and that's what they're going to be signing off on before they hand it to you. The second part is the demographic part, and that's the section that only you know, only your family really knows, right? Nobody else knows all of those veterans' things and people's middle names and what street you grew up on and that kind of thing. So this is pretty easy. You complete that by using your worksheet because you have one shot at completing it in black ink. No cross-outs, no white-outs, right? It has to be done correctly. No pressure there either. And then you're going to take it down to your town clerk in the town where the person died. So if they died at home, you're going to go to your local town clerk. And they're going to then take the death certificate, which is their worksheet, and they're going to input that into an electronic system, which works beautifully. We have 36 hours to do this. So again, you can make it through. If somebody dies at Friday night, you can wait till Monday to go and do this. It's a good idea, though. Sometimes, no clock. Nobody's got a stopwatch. Nobody's there saying your time is running up. You know, you just want to, again, if you hold off on calling the hospice nurse, they're gonna, you know, until Saturday midday, if they died on a Friday, then the clock starts when they say that when they declare that death. So it gives you a little more cushion. But I can tell you that I've had this happen before, where I had someone, her mom died on Friday night, and she went through the weekend thinking she'd be fine to do the paperwork, but Monday was Martin Luther King Day, Tuesday was an ice storm, Wednesday was cleanup of the ice storm, so she didn't get it filed until Thursday. She was panicked. Nothing happened to her. Didn't go to jail or anything. It was just fine. But you do want to. It's nice to have a good relationship with your local town clerk anyway, but this is another reason to, is to be able to give them a call and say, hey, I've got this, I'd really like to get this passed through, so give it a try. What's going to happen then is that information goes to Vital Statistics in Concord, and they're going to push another button when it's accepted, and it then prints out that permit I was talking about, that FedEx ticket. They hand that to you, and off you go. Paperwork done. And that's how you get that transport permit.
So the town clerk hands it to you?
Yes.
While you're waiting?
Yes. Yeah, it just takes a little while for them to input the information and then to push that button and off you go. It's really not, that's what I mean. If you can get a driver's license, believe me, you can do this. This is not tough. If there's a cremation, there's going to be a cremation form that is going to be signed. If it's a burial instead, you have 6 days then to complete that permit, which is also the burial permit, and bring it back to the town clerk. So again, plenty of time to do everything. Not a big deal. back and forth. Those certified copies that you might need to give to an insurance company or the bank or whatever, just get what you need. You can go back and get more later. First copy costs a little bit more than the others, but subsequent copies, you can just keep going back to any town clerk because it's a statewide system, and you can pick up another one. You really don't need to have a lot of expensive pieces of paper hanging around your house that you're never going to use. So the last thing that you want to do is notify Social Security, which even if you hire a professional, I recommend that within 30 days you contact Social Security, make sure that, first of all, everything got filed, and second, that it got filed correctly. I don't know if anybody else saw the 60 Minutes program a few years ago with all of the people who had been declared dead but really weren't. But because they'd been declared dead by the Social Security, they're in limbo forever. So, yeah, you want to make sure that the information is correct. And Veterans Affairs as well. You want to contact Veterans Affairs if that's part of the picture. And I can tell you here in New Hampshire, they are absolutely stunning. They're just wonderful, incredibly helpful. They do everything. They bend over backwards to help you walk through this process, even if you're doing it yourself. So that's the paperwork. I know it sounds like a lot. It's just there are a few different steps, but it's very, very simple in the end. So that's home funerals for you, and we can talk about more things in a bit. I'm going to move on to the environmental issues that we're dealing with, because that's the funeral piece, right? A lot of people, you know, I'll say, so have you planned your funeral? And they say, yeah, I'm going to be cremated. I go, well, that's not really a funeral. That's a disposition method. So we're going to talk now about disposition methods. And the first one to get over is cremation. I think a lot of people have been choosing this over the last few years because they think it's greener. And of course, it's not greener than conventional burial. There are a lot of things that are going on. Some of them we're just discovering. We're doing quite a bit of work with the national organizations that are involved with cremation at the Green Burial Council in order to try and really get down to what the environmental pros and cons are of cremation. But you can see the numbers here. Lots of fossil fuel. Mercury from our teeth. Those of us with old amalgam fillings. It was amazing to me. A couple of months ago, I saw my dentist, and I asked him, I said, you know, I could swear I still have an amalgam in here. I've been replacing these for years, trying to get them out. And he said, well, why would you want to? And I told him, and he was absolutely stunned. The dental community knows nothing about the dangers of that mercury that's going up the stacks and down into our waterways. But that is one of the problems. And there are other elements, too, other materials in our body. Lots of CO2 goes into the atmosphere, and all of those byproduct emissions. Radiopharmaceutical contamination is another piece that's just coming up. There's an article in the last few months from the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, documenting the growing incidence of certain types of cancer in crematory operators. And they were trying to locate why. And what they discovered was that it's very preliminary, there'll be more studies going on, but the preliminary study revealed that it's the seed-like radiation for things like prostate cancer and breast cancer when it's quite fresh and then the person dies and is cremated. Those are flying around all over the place. So there's contamination concerns. So there's that. But the big one for you and me, I mean, this is the one that really matters in the end to me. The final product is not ashes. It's not, that's a very romantic idea. It's pulverized bone. It's what's left because this is not a complete process. You're not done yet. You've still got 7 to 10 pounds of very heavy pulverized bone that's made up of its basic elements of calcium, phosphate, and sodium. Things don't grow in this. This is an inert thing. So put it in the ocean with salt, no problem. Put it in the ground under a rose bush, dead rose bush. Because all of the roots are gonna try and get as far away as they can, okay? Keep that in mind for later when we're talking about some products. So cremation still, in some ways, makes sense for us. I'm not saying throw it off your list. I'm just saying be aware that there's a cost to it.
And to go back to the lawn cemeteries, this fellow is looking at an exposed area of vaults. This is kind of what things look like underground. All right, they're trying to get the bodies as close together as they can to be able to fit as many into the cemetery as possible. And, you know, that makes sense for our municipalities for sure. But it's also putting in an awful lot of concrete in the ground that will really never do anything. It takes about 500 years for it to start to decompose. It will crack, but it won't really go anywhere. So it's going to crack, and the water's going to get in there, and it's going to be kind of a mess anyway. We're also putting in all this copper and bronze and steel and thinking about where those things come from, particularly the steel, right? I mean, there's Chinese steel and then there's Canadian steel, and believe me, it's not Bethlehem steel. But that's coming and be bouncing around all over the world, really. So that's got a carbon footprint to transportation, as do all of these other elements. And particularly those hardwoods. These hardwoods are mostly coming from South America, where we're Amazon rainforest fires made an impact on the ability to harvest mahogany and other types of exotic woods that are often used in caskets that we then bring up the seaboard and we take it to the middle of the country and turn into caskets, and then that gets dispersed around the country. Again, enormous footprint for these products. And what we've learned also when thinking about these things being in the ground, a lot of the fear that people have around green burial, with not using a casket, not using that vault, again, neither of them is protective in any way for any really lengthy period of time. What we've learned, though, through research in disaster sites and in cemeteries that have been problematic, when we study what the ground and the water looks like around those particular cemeteries, it's what's leaching from the caskets. It's not the bodies that are causing the problems. It's the breakdown of the what we call the furniture that we're putting in there that's causing the problems. The embalming fluid is a whole other piece to talk about. A lot of people get very, very worried about this. Yes, embalming fluid has a lot of toxic things in it, benzene and window washing fluid and all kinds of stuff, along with the formaldehyde, which we know is a known carcinogen. I don't worry about it particularly because it dissipates within a couple of weeks. It's really not that big a deal for the cemeteries. We're not thrilled with it. We don't want it in there, but it's nothing. It's not the real point of being upset about it. This is the real point. Embalmers and funeral directors who embalm, they're not necessarily the same thing, have a 13 times higher risk of early death from the general population. 8 times higher risk of myeloid leukemia and other blood diseases, particularly blood cancers. 3 times higher risk of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And lots of cardiopulmonary disease problems and neurological diseases. The number of funeral directors nationwide with Parkinson's is way out of whack. We don't have the numbers on it, but we know that's in particular. So these neurological things are a problem. Well, we studied these guys because, you know, they're professionals, so we've got the numbers on them. You look at the maintenance workers, the guys who are out there cleaning the stones and spreading the pesticides and the herbicides. I used to be a runner back in the day. Loved running in cemeteries. No bugs. It was lovely, right? Sucking it all in. Well, we know that they have increased risk of cardiopulmonary and other respiratory disease, COPD, neurological diseases, cancers, and all kinds of other things. But we don't study them the way that we study professionals. So there's other issues here. There's worker safety, and there's social justice issues around all of this type of work. So it digs deeper and deeper into something's not quite right with this picture. I want to mention the cost of all of this to towns, too. In the state of New Hampshire, it's mandatory that each town provide burial space for its own residents. And you may have noticed this. You may like a cemetery 3 towns over and want to be buried there, but they prefer to bury only the people from their own town, so you have to go back to your own town. And we're finding this particularly as more of these cemeteries are flipping to add green options. People are running from all over the place, and they're having to say no because they've got limited space. Well, essentially what we are when we are buried in municipal cemeteries is we're sort of absentee property owners. It's a real estate transaction. You own the spot. And
in some of these towns, we're running out of space. My town is on its 16th cemetery. Some of those are historical cemeteries that might have been family cemeteries even that got really large. But basically, you know, once we fill up, we're going to have to go and buy more property. I live right next to Holderness on Squam Lake. I know down in Sunapee, they're having the same issue. Their cemeteries are getting filled up, and they now have to buy $500,000 an acre properties in order to meet the mandate. So this puts great strain on taxpayers and municipalities to keep these going and filling them up with these concrete underground parking lots where they can't reuse that property for anything else. So it's a burden to municipalities and to taxpayers. It also takes that off the rolls. So this is something worth mentioning if you're a taxpayer. Cost to you. Here's the average. I put these figures together for the Vermont legislature when they were considering green burial legislation, which did pass and has passed twice now, so they're in great shape. We don't need it here in New Hampshire because we already had permission to bury green if we need to or want to. But the general bottom line here is the average price in the U.S. is somewhere between $4,000 and $11,000 for plots. Now that $11,000 is pretty high, but I can tell you that in Brooklyn, New York, at Greenwood Cemetery, you start at about $18,000 a plot. So that it throws the average off. But it still compares pretty favorably. Green burial is favorable, somewhere around $25,000 or so. A lot of people ask me, why is it different? Well, it's different because you're not buying a vault and you're not embalming and you're not doing a whole lot of things. But more importantly, pricing has to do with location. It's a real estate transaction. So if you are selling a $400 plot in Dover, then it doesn't matter what they put in it other than the body. It's nobody's business, really, other than the cemetery trustees. And that isn't going to change. That price isn't going to change. So if we can reduce a lot of the things that were, you can see on the list here, why wouldn't we? Environmentally and cost-wise. Which brings us to green burial. The real definition of green burial is burying unimpeded. We just don't want to impede the decomposition, the natural decomposition of the body. And that's what all the things that we're putting in right now are doing. So we're saying no vaults, and we're saying no embalming. We want things to get on their business naturally with all those lovely little coffin beetles and all those great little nature things I didn't want to know anything about when I was in school and now fascinate me. We're looking at using organic maintenance methods. Again, no herbicides, no pesticides, no fertilizers. Looking at different ways of managing the land. Again, cost savings to the town as well. Using biodegradable containers, and we're going to talk about a few of those and look at them. Biggest issue that most people have is the depth. In fact, in Vermont, we had to go back to the depth issue because they couldn't handle it the first time through. There were people who were absolutely adamant that if they buried at 3.5 to 4 feet, then there were going to be vultures living over the cemetery and all kinds of crazy stuff. The fact is that, 3.5 to 4 feet is essentially where the body is right now. It's just got a lot of stuff all around it, and under it. It's the right place to be for all of those lovely microbes to do their work. So that's why we want to be there. That 18 to 24 inch, we call it the smell barrier, that's what we're going to have from the top of the body to the horizon of the land. But then we're going to mound that displaced soil above and just let it naturally settle. So you can imagine that there's really no animal that's going to dig that deep to get to something they're not really interested in anyway. I'm sorry, you're not that delicious. And they're much more interested in live prey above. In fact, the one big complaint that I've gotten is from Foxfield Conservation Cemetery in Ohio. They have a terrible time with skunks because they like to come and eat the fresh grubs that get dug up. So if that's all we have to worry about, honestly, I'm good. One of the concerns, too, by the way, with the vault, serves a couple other purposes. One is to avoid grave subsidence, which means having the sides fall in, Well, if you're going 5 or 6 feet, you have to worry about that. If you're going 3.5, it's really not that big a deal, and we have ways of shoring that up. The other piece is that if we're not mowing the lawn, although you might still be mowing the lawn, you don't have to have the concrete there to keep it flat to avoid divots for the guy who's mowing. That's really one of the main reasons for it. And, you know, we're just a little more organic about it. And you can see in the horizons of land, you want to be as high up as you can for all of that wonderful in that subsoil. You want to have the opportunity for all of those, you know, lovely roots to come down and actually benefit from the organic matter that's decomposing. So it isn't just a matter of going out green this way. It's that how do our bodies in the ground benefit? A friend of mine said to me a while ago, she was had just driven through the Shenandoah Valley, and she thought to herself, what would the Shenandoah Valley look like right now if everybody had been cremated who died in the Civil War, as opposed to having been buried right there? And I think it's an interesting question. Types of green burials. We basically look at this in three standard models. One is the hybrid cemetery, your municipal cemetery, your town cemetery. In many of them, they're burying either in between graves that were already there. They're setting aside a space nearby to do it, which is kind of nice as well, so that you can maintain it differently if you need to. It makes it a little easier. I have one town in New Hampshire that is working on a plan to develop green space that it's unusable for burial right now, right in the middle of the cemetery. It's like an S-curve of weird land, and they said, oh, well, perfect. We'll bury there, and we'll just build a wildflower garden, and it'll become a feature of the cemetery. What could be better? So there are lots of different ways to do hybrid or local cemeteries. The next level is natural cemeteries. People who are building cemeteries now with the intent that it is a cemetery and they're going to bury green, here are the rules, and that's it. So that's their push. Then there's a whole other group, and I work with another group called the Conservation Burial Alliance. It's all of the conservation level cemetery operators in the country, and we're just together last week working on plans to bring in more activity from Sierra Club. You know, we've been writing articles for the Sierra Club and the Land Trust Alliance and so on. The point of this is that we're trying to get conservation land trusts and land entities who are preserving land, which is important to us as New Englanders. We want to use burial as a conservation strategy for bringing people to the land, seeing value in the land, actually tying people to the land through the burial of a loved one. The money that goes toward that then gets flipped back to the conservation entity so that they are able to purchase more land and conserve more land. So there's a deep relationship between land trust entities. And the other piece about this is that we're looking in all of these cemeteries, we're looking at opportunities to use cemeteries for life-affirming activity, not just a place to warehouse the dead. We're looking at recreational opportunities and educational opportunities. Agriculture, I mean, there's lots of things we can be doing in these lands. And the idea is that we're using these lands to rebury at some point, right? So we're conserving land, we're going to be restoring land, and we're going to, in 500 years, be reusing land near or of someone who might have been buried before. We're doing this now in historical cemeteries where we don't know where their bodies were buried, and it doesn't matter because we're all part of the earth then, and we're all doing it together. So that's the point of those. Home burial is something that we can do here in New Hampshire. I only know of one town, that would be Keene, and it's the city of Keene that doesn't allow it. Their zoning doesn't allow home burial. But you want to check with your local zoning boards. But basically, the thing to know about burying someone at home is that it's for family members only. You don't just have 10 acres and tell everybody they can come on down and you'll take care of them. It has to be a family member. And again, it's pretty easy. You record it with your cemetery trustees in your town, and you want to put it on the property transfer deed at the time of the transfer. You don't even have to do it now. You could do it 20 years from now or whenever. You want to provide a public right-of-way, meaning that you simply have a notification somewhere in the works that says, here's where you park, you know, someone in the future is going to park the car, here's where they're going to walk, and here's where the grave is. So it's that kind of right away. You don't have to build anything. In New Hampshire, you have to be located 100 feet from any dwelling, school, store, business, 50 feet from known water sources or a state highway. That's pretty easy to meet. It's not really that onerous. And again, complying with zoning ordinances. Basically, this is the same pattern, too. If you were to, and I've had this family, this is a gentleman, one of my hospice patients. I've been a hospice volunteer in various capacities for about 38 years now. And this is one of my more recent ones. His daughters called me because they wanted to know what funeral home I should call. And so I gave them all the information about the funeral homes. But I said, well, your family's been on this farmland for generations. What would you think about keeping him home and burying him here? Well, in no time at all, they'd raised all the neighbors. Someone had come and dug the hole, the grave, down by the fence line that Pierce had helped his great-grandfather maintain. And everyone, when he died, they bathed him, cared for him, called all the neighbors. Everybody went out, and you can see they kept him, they buried him in a shroud. They kept his face open to the sky until they got to the burial. And then they had this very organic and spontaneous ceremony. Buried him, everyone grabbed a shovel, everyone helped, and then they went back to the house, had a marvelous meal together. And everybody in Holderness is still talking about it everywhere I go. Because it resonates with people. So there are real reasons to do it. One of the questions I get is, what about property values? You know, we're in New England. There are a lot of people who want to have a place that's got a family cemetery on it. You know, I always say it's the difference between having Marilyn Monroe in your backyard and Sid Vicious. Because, you know, maybe one's going to make somebody think that the property's more or less. It's all in whatever the person who's purchasing your property, you know, what they believe. It's very common, most of us. You know, who live in rural areas probably have somebody there, whether we know it or not. Transportation, these are some of the reasons that we're doing this and how we're doing it, just so you have an idea. We're doing these types of things like transporting the bodies in differently. You can see we're trying not to have all these service vehicles and everything coming in, because a lot of the properties that we're burying on, you know, these are lands that we're trying to take better care of. So we're keeping vehicles out. And it, again, what that does is bring in the procession, something that we've lost, another ceremonial piece where we can reclaim the meaning and the activity of doing things shoulder to shoulder that is really helpful. Again, return of ceremony is really important. Graveside ceremonies particularly. One of the things with green burials is that we just assume that the family or friends, whoever is involved, is going to come and participate. We even have kid-sized shovels for little ones. Another example, so you can see family participation and how important that is. I also want to mention this is a veteran who was buried at Steelmantown Cemetery in New Jersey. This was really quite lovely. It's quite common, we found, both with home funerals and with green burial, is that our veterans are very, very interested in both of these activities. And you would think that they would want to take advantage of the free services, the veteran services, right? Because you get free grave and marker and all kinds of things. But what I've learned is that in talking to several veterans about this, it depends on their war, the reason that they're choosing green burial. If you talk to a Vietnam vet, they might tell you that they don't want to be part of that system, you know, that whole military-industrial complex thing, and they want to be in the ground. You talk to anyone before that, if you can catch anybody who's still around, they'll tell you that they want to be buried in the soil of the country that they fought for. There's all kinds of reasons for veterans to be choosing this, and it's a big deal. And we've been working with the Veterans Administration in D.C. We're actually opening green space at Fort Knox. Fort Knox has 160 cemeteries, can you believe that? And California, we've already got green space in the state cemetery, so everybody's paying attention to this. I think the Maine Veterans is also working on this. So important to know. I want to show you alternate containers. These are basically cardboard boxes that are used for people to go to the crematory. But we can use them for burial as well. They're completely biodegradable. And the beauty of them is that we can decorate them ahead of time. When the medical examiner came to my house to see my mom to sign off, she was a little bit surprised walking by the dining room table where my grandsons were drawing all over the box, right? We'd also put sayings. My mom and dad had lots of sayings. They had a saying for everything. And one of my favorites at the head of my mom's cremation container was "off like a dirty shirt," which is what she said to my dad every time she kissed him when he went back to lunch during the day. And at the bottom, it was my absolute favorite one that she would say every time she'd stop the car and tell us kids we were going to get out. She would say, "If you guys don't stop fighting, I'm going to run away from home." So she finally ran away home. So these have great therapeutic value, and they can be very, very beautiful. And gives people something to do. Remember, I was talking about the building community. People come by your house. They bring the casserole with the name under it, and they pick up a pen and they write a message. It's really lovely. One of the other examples that I have of that I think is good to know, and I think you may have seen the picture here, or you will see the picture of a young woman with a dog and her grandfather behind her, Opa, who was from the he actually spent 2 years in a hidden ceiling in Amsterdam during the war. He was highly prized by the Nazis. He was an optical engineer, and they managed to keep him safe. He immigrated to the U.S. and brought his family here. And when he died, even as a Jew, the family chose at his bidding to cremate him. That's not a common thing. And he did it because he wanted to do it in honor of all of those in his family who had died in the camps. So they created a timeline all the way around the box with the names of all the people in the family who had died during the war. And they didn't have their final dates, but they were finally acknowledged. So this can be a very, very powerful tool for a lot of reasons. Shrouds are interesting. You can buy very expensive, beautiful ones that have all kinds of things going on with them, or you can use a lovely little $4 cotton sheet and make it all equally beautiful. What you see on the left is underneath is the shrouding board. You don't have to have that. Again, that's pretty fancy, but we need something with structure in order to move the body. Again, it's kind of a beautiful way to do it and to go out as simply as possible. Caskets. We can make them out of all kinds of things, all kinds of biodegradable materials and organic materials. What we want to be careful about, though, is something we call greenwashing, and that's when we have products. These are not greenwashing. These are lovely hand. This is felting shrouds. Beautiful final product. This gentleman's up in Vermont. He makes lots and lots of caskets for people, all different sizes. By the way, this is called a toe pincher. This kind that goes like this to save money on the wood. But what we're concerned about is a lot of products that are out there. They say that they're green, but actually, I already explained about the footprint and everything else. So if you have, for instance, you see a wicker casket at a funeral home or for sale anywhere, you want to find out for sure where that wicker casket was made. It might be made right here in Vermont or Massachusetts. We have a couple of really great basket weavers now. But a lot of them are made in Indonesia by very tiny hands, and then they're transported all the way here. So we're concerned about child labor, concerned about what goes into making these products, and then get sold here in the use in the U.S. as being green. So you want to look at the whole picture. So that's the environmental piece of things. Everybody okay? We're going to go through a few more quick things before we get to questions. Because part of the questions I always get is, what about body donation? Body donation is fine if you know what you're doing. You want to be thinking about this long term, though. If you sign up for body donation when you're 20, they're going to love you. But when you show up when you're 80 and you're riddled with cancer, they aren't. You have to understand that you can still be refused right up to the moment that you're brought there, which then means you need a different plan. But if it goes according to plan the way you want it to, you want to be sure you look at the contract, make sure that your body is going to be used for what you want it to be used for, because not everyone gets to be a cadaver in a medical school. Other bodies are taken apart and used for research for different things around the country. The provider does pay for a cremation, but you don't know for sure what you're getting, pieces and parts you're getting back sometimes. And it may take up to a couple of years, which is very distressing to some people. So you want to make sure this isn't just a decision you make on your own. You want to involve other people. Burial at sea is a real thing. Right here in Portsmouth, we've got Captain Brad, who will take you out past the 3 mile mark or whatever the number is, still doing full body, and the Navy still does burial at sea. There's another thing on the horizon here in New Hampshire. It's been legal and then made illegal again, alkaline hydrolysis. You might hear it called green cremation, which is a total fallacy because cremation means incineration by fire. This is basically wet cremation. It's a water and lye process that dissolves the soft tissues of the body. Again, it's an incomplete process because in the end you've got all those bones to pulverize. And even though it uses less energy, it is high in water, which is also a pretty important resource here. So there are concerns. It's getting legalized state by state around the country. The issue is that the units cost a tremendous amount of money, and most of our funeral homes that finally got on with the cremation piece are still paying off their crematories. So they don't really, you don't have the $350,000 to buy one of these units. Closest one is Belfast, Maine, to us, if that appeals to you. A couple other quick things, the environmental offsets. Again, we're talking about cremation. What's a way that if you choose to go through cremation, you can make that process at least a little bit more earth-friendly? One is to add it to these reef balls that are made of concrete. Again, a way to use concrete that is quite different. They expect they're going to work for about 500 years. Within a couple of, you know, the family can go and add the cremated remains to the slurry. They build the reef ball. You can go out on the ship when they lower the reef balls into the reefs to rebuild them, because we're losing those, and then that marine life starts up. Within a couple of months, it's actively working. So it's an interesting way to give back. Cost you more up and above, over and above, but there's something to it. Another piece is this product called Let Your Love Grow. This is an enzyme product that, with other supplements, actually breaks down those cremated remains further. This is a remarkable product. It's taking off like crazy in Europe because, you know, there's a lot of cremation there. And this could change the way that we look at cremation as well in order to be able to remove that last bit. This is another piece you may have heard of a bit, recomposition. This is Katrina Spade, who's from the Upper Valley here, lives in Seattle now, and she's come up with this process that basically mimics green burial decomposition above ground. And so far, it's been really good. The research has been pretty amazing, showing that most of the pharmaceuticals and pathogens and other soluble metals do get reduced. And things like Valium, people taking Valium, this is a problem for us, right? If someone is embalmed and there's Valium in the system, embalming fluids, by the way, don't go on a spaceship out into outer space. They go into your local septic system or water treatment plant when someone's embalmed. So we have some concerns about that in our water treatment plants about these drugs like Valium, diazepam, other things. What we found with this process is that it is about 95% mitigated. So this is something that's going to really be taking off in urban areas particularly. So it's an organic process that gets speeded up and takes the place of green burial, which we can't really do in cities very well. So keep your eye on that. Another thing people ask me about is open air cremation. It's legal in the state of Colorado. There's one place where you can do it. You can't do this on backyard Barbie. People ask me all the time, no, illegal. So here's a few more things you might have seen. This is a BioCern, and they're going to try and sell you these. These are actual things, but again, watch out. They're big. It looks very small, but it's very big. And it's sort of like a bunch of Miracle-Gro, and you put the cremains in, and for a little while something grows, and then, you know, it hits that sodium, and all of the nutrients that are added to it get depleted. And eventually whatever you put in there dies. So watch out for that. And it's pretty costly. Here's another one. This is J. Rim Lee, who came up with this idea as an MIT art student. And she thought she would use shiitake mushroom spores and inoculate a suit, and that would make the body decompose more rapidly. She was interested in speed. Most of us in the Green Burial world aren't really concerned about speed. We kind of think we're going to bury it and let nature take its course and not worry. But this became a big thing. She did a TED Talk, and everybody got excited about it. A few months ago, Luke Perry, the actor, was buried in one of these suits in Maine. And the issue, though, is that it doesn't work. It doesn't. She isn't using shiitake mushrooms anymore. She's using something else. But the big issue for us is that, first of all, it's not getting, you're not burying the body at the right depth for this to actually proliferate. The second is we don't need it. We don't need to fast forward everything. And the most difficult thing for us to really deal with is the fact that if you're going to put what these spores in the ground in a place where they don't exist, you might be introducing an invasive species. If you're putting them where it's already there, then why do you need more? So it's another one of those gimmicky things that's out there. Here's another good gimmicky thing. This looks like it's big enough to put an entire body in, but it's actually this big. It's a cremation urn. This is from Italy. It's called Capsula Mundi, and it is on their website. They say that it's made of biodegradable plastic. The people who do this, I mean, they're promising that someday in the future you are going to be able to actually fold grandma up and put her in it. And I, every cemeterian I've ever talked to about this has just started to cry, because there's no way you're burying something like that deep enough and carting it around and everything else. But it's an idea. The owners admit they just want people to be thinking. This last one is a thing, but it's about to become not a thing. This is called Better Place Forests, and you may have seen it even on early morning TV shows and stuff. It's a Silicon Valley venture capitalist group who has been buying up areas like big areas of redwoods on the West Coast, or one of their latest ones was buying Native American sacred land in Flagstaff, Arizona, to offer people the opportunity to bread their loved ones' cremated remains over the roots or under the roots of those redwood trees or in that Native American sacred soil. And they're tanking. Thank goodness. You can imagine, again, what the conservation community thinks about this. They use the language of conservation, but they are not involved in any way with those conservation entities. So when you hear Better Place Forests or any kind of thing that resembles this, just keep in mind, if it's cremated remains, we're not putting it anywhere like that and expecting good things. Here's a couple of things that are really not things that people still call me and say, gee, I want to have my body freeze-dried and shaken and then buried in the earth. And I tell them the company was dissolved in 2015, and it's not a thing. There's no scientific basis for it. Just take that one off your radar. Here's another one I get a lot. And this is particularly interesting. I had a go-around with a woman in Oakland, California, who wanted to take her friend who is terminally ill. When she had died, she wanted to take her up to the rooftop in Oakland and let the vultures get, you know, pick her. Tibetan sky burial, it is a real thing, and there are actually four different types of sky burial. The Tibetan's the one that most of us know the most. The problem with this is that the vultures themselves are now dying off in droves because they've been exposed to the heavy metals and chemicals in the bodies of the people that they're supposed to be clearing. Particularly ibuprofen is killing them off. So it's that's something that's going away. And no, you're not dragging your body out into the backyard, and, you know, that kind of thing. Anti-desecration laws in the U.S. are still in force, so this doesn't make a lot of sense. And by the way, that Oakland, those Oakland vultures, I think they're called seagulls. Then there's this one. This is just, I mean, this is incredible. They interviewed me at NPR a couple of years ago, and I'm sitting in this room while we're taping this thing, full of these handsome young men, And they're all going, yeah, Viking funeral, Viking funeral. I was like, yeah, you're not Sean Connery. You're good looking, but you're not Sean Connery. This really is not a thing. It was very common for the elite of the Viking community to be cremated. They often cremated, but they were mostly buried on land. This would have been a symbolic gesture, but the body wouldn't have been in it. Think about it. Who's shooting arrows on, you know, whatever pond or lake in New Hampshire? We're not doing it. Who does that? Fire on water. How long will that last? So that's what I've got for you, and I know you're going to have questions. I hope I answered a lot of them during the talk, but I guess the biggest thing I want to emphasize before we start up is that I do believe that your choices matter. I know it's just one of us who's dying that one time, but it still matters to me that when I go, that my family cares for me in a way that is congruent with the way that I've lived in my life. And I am certainly looking for a green burial experience for the same reason, hoping that over time I will no longer be there and someone else can come take my place, because that's the way that we're going to keep burial sustainable and meaningful. That's what I've got for you. Have I got someone doing? You want to do it? Great. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer. We've got someone running a microphone to you.
Are those transport permits good for crossing state lines?
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I always forget to tell you some of the meatier stuff. There are no state lines when it comes to this. That burial permit is attesting to the fact that the person died in the state, and it's perfectly legal. And the big question I ask is, you know, when's the last time you drove from here to Kittery and had somebody stop you and check your truck for a dead body? It's not happening, right? I've actually had people who have been stopped while they had someone for other reasons, you know, for a tail light out. And that's always a fun conversation. But it always, every story ends with the state trooper or the local sheriff or whoever escorting them the rest of the way to their destination. Every single one. Because it's legal. Yeah.
The burials at sea, are they considered green?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they always have been, and it does make sense. I mean, we're far out to sea. We're not doing this. Again, same thing with cremated remains. If you're gonna do a water scattering, yeah, do it in the ocean where we've got that sodium. The calcium phosphate isn't gonna hurt anything. You know, it's all gonna disperse and all that. That's the place where cremated remains make the most sense. Yeah, you have to be well offshore, and remember, yeah, it does come back in. I've had a lot of people. There are some products on the market that are made of paper mache or actually made of gelatin and cornstarch, and they're lovely because you can fit cremated remains in them. They look like paper mache, you know, boxes and so on. And you put them on the water, and it takes about 7 minutes for the bottom to start to dissolve, and then it all sinks. Which is lovely if you've taken a canoe far enough out, or you've taken a boat far enough out, then you can have a water ceremony of some kind and do that. It's all perfectly biodegradable and can be very moving and lovely. But you want to be far enough out, because I had someone do it not far enough out, and then they were chasing the remains down the shoreline through trees and stuff. So, yeah.
I didn't mean cremated, I meant the entire body.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, still done. Again, very far out.
Yes, I have two questions. First of all, how do you connect with someone that can help you with things like storage of the body in instances where it's inconvenient time, or transportation of the body? One is green burial, because I don't have family that are going to do that.
Right, and that's why we have funeral professionals. And often that's what people are really looking to funeral directors to do when they want to take back a little more of the control and have someone stay at home a little bit longer, but it's just not feasible for them to keep them, you know, until the cremation or burial. Which is another thing to mention, there's a 48-hour mandatory wait time between the time that someone dies and when they can be cremated. So the body does have to be somewhere. Can be home, can stay in the hospital morgue, can they have room and they're willing to do that, or you can ask a funeral home
Is there any connection of finding some funeral homes willing to do this kind of thing?
They'll all be willing to help you. No, they'll help you. They'll all help you. It's what they do.
It kind of burst my bubble when you said, think about the pods.
Yeah, sorry about that.
but it makes me think, because I like the idea of being burrow, and I would love to have some sort of marker other than a stone, but a tree to sort of mark that place. And so mm-hmm. Can you plant the body with a tree or something? Is that organic enough materials to sustain the life of the tree?
Sure. With a green burial, yeah, absolutely. And that's really the point of the green burial, as I was talking about before. It's not just that we're not going to put junk in the ground. It's that we're hoping that our bodies will be beneficial and will be part of the restoration process for lands that we're trying to conserve and preserve. So yes, a lot of people have a very romantic idea that every single person who's buried is going to have a whole great big oak tree over them. Well, that's not realistic in terms of cemetery management. All right, we're talking about sustainability management too. So you may or may not be allowed to do that depending on where the burial occurs. But there are ways around that. Markers too, you mentioned that. We tend to try to use field stone or some kind of native stone and not great big monoliths. In some places, maybe an art installation of some kind or names at the beginning, you know, on a stone at the entrance to the space. There's lots of different ways for us to memorialize that doesn't have to be huge things. So I did want to mention that too.
Who's actually digging the actual hole, or does it have to be shown that it's deep enough,
No, again, nobody's standing around with a yardstick, but the cemetery sextons are the ones who will do this. Even in green burial cemeteries where the family might stay and help fill up, for liability reasons, they tend to have someone else actually do the opening of the grave. If you're in a cemetery. If you're at home, it's all on you.
Because that's a lot of work, right?
It is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot less work at 3.5 feet than 5, I can tell you that. Yeah.
Two things is, you really educated me a lot today. When my parents died, I sprinkled them on the bushes like they wanted to. But I had two questions. One is it healthy, given the fact that, you know, it has mercury and things like that, but people do these reef things or are making cement and all that? And the other thing is, do people ever have the experience that the bodies move? They say they can move up to months going into it. I was just reading that on the web the other day.
You gotta stop going to that website.
Because I thought maybe the nerves.
No, bodies remain in situ. There's no place for them to go. They're surrounded by soil. They stay right where they are. There's something called plume, all right, and you can have plume if there was a lot of contamination, which comes from the casket or whatever breaking down. We have no evidence of organic material going out into any place. Bodies don't move. Once they're situated, they're staying where they are.
But if it's not good to have the body going into the air, if it has, you know, these contaminants, how can it be good to put it into cement and reefs and things like that?
Well, by the time you've completed the cremation and it's going to go into a reef ball, all of that is already done. It's gone. That's it. That material that's going in the reef ball is inert. Okay, it's only calcium phosphate.
It become inert? I mean, after...
After it's been incinerated.
After it's all done. Okay.
Yeah, once it's been incinerated, it's gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, I've seen a couple of TED Talks on the mushroom bag. Well, one was on a mushroom bag and one was on a pile of toxins that they put the mushrooms in and it turned to total soil, no mm-hmm. contaminants, and there's no CO2. Have you got any scientific data that shows that it's an unviable solution?
Yeah, actually, I've got a couple of papers. Sorry, I have to do the microphone. I can't see you. but yes, we do have some, and I can certainly send you to those sources. And you'll find those on the Green Burial Council under academic research, and you'll see a great deal about this. So, and I'm not surprised that you found that. It worked in a certain circumstance. However, when they went to do the, I believe there was an academic institution involved in it, they were testing the suit in Austin, Texas at Eloise Woods, and they got partway through, realized it didn't work, and they pulled up their tent and left and didn't complete the study.
I was just wondering if there's any purpose to bathing the body right after death.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. One is that we want to remove any surface bacteria. If the body is going to stay until it's time for the cremation, which is a couple of days, or a burial, we certainly want the body to be clean. There is Buddhist philosophy of not touching the body after the death, and so we honor that. But, you know, not everybody dies the perfect, beautiful, in their sleep death. Okay, it can be very messy, so we do want to clean up. The other aspect is it's the ritual aspect of it. There is something deeply connective about bathing, even if it is just the hands and the face. So, and it's a choice that you as a family member can make, how far you go with that.
So I just want to thank you for doing this. I've been telling my husband, listen, if something happens to me, I want to be buried in the ground, you know, up in Canterbury. Our cat died about 6 months ago, and we brought the cat, and we had him euthanized at the vet, and then we took her home and we buried her. And that, I think, is just doing that, putting her in a pillowcase in the ground, even just that process was so good for us, and that was just solidified my conviction that, and I see where she is in the backyard, that little spot, you know, I know she's there, and I don't think I can get. I want to be buried in the little urban area that I am in Penacook, New Hampshire. But mm-hmm. Canterbury's got a great spot, and we're working on that. So I
yes,
just
I know.
And I think it's just that whole idea of just getting more connected with death. I was with a dear right. friend of mine when he passed, and he died at home. His mom was taking care of him. He had AIDS back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had coffee in the kitchen, and we would take turns going over by his body as he laid in his pajamas in the parlor. And it just seemed so much more, it was still heart-wrenching, but it was so much more natural than all the crazy stuff that we've been doing.
Yeah. I think a lot of people feel that way. Now, a lot of people are really comforted by what they see as the way it has to be done, because it's the way that, you know, we've been doing it for a while. Yeah, a lot of people are just saying, you know, I just don't want to do all that. I don't want to schedule my grief. I don't want to just show up and do it, you know, Tuesday from 6 to 8. I want to immerse myself in this. And, you know, and in hospice, that's the way we look at this, right? And we're looking, there's only one way around it, and that's through it. So we feel the same way about caring for our own dead. And you know, it's just, it takes a little bit to not be afraid of someone who's died. We're not used to being with the dead anymore. And once we are, we realize it all falls away, and we're fine.
What about chemotherapy remaining in the body?
Yeah, good question. And that's where the research from the recomposition folks at the University of Washington comes in. Part of what they discovered, and in fact, they had several cadavers people who had chosen to leave their bodies to this specific experiment. And I think two of them were cancer patients, full-on chemo, radiation, the whole thing. And what they discovered was that in all of the testing for those pharmaceuticals were well below EPA standards for it. So it was a huge relief to discover that. And when you think about it, that's in an accelerated above ground process. If you think about green burial, what's happening is all of those roots are coming down and all of those heavy metals and so on are getting bound. They bind, and there's chelation, I think is the term for this. And so again, it stays in place. It's not going all over the place. It's actually getting, it's an uptake process. And it can actually be bound, and then all the good stuff gets used.
Are there any places in New Hampshire that do that recomposition?
No, recomposition is legal in the state of Washington and the Seattle area, but no facility's been built yet, and they're working right now to work on the regulation process. So it's going to be many, many years before it gets anywhere else. But as I say, it mimics green burial. That we do right here.
My driver's license says I'm an organ donor. I have no clue the process once I die, how that's going to work. Do you know how that works?
Yeah, basically it's going to depend on how you die.
Because they need to get those organs quickly.
Right. It's the golden hour is what they call it. So they need about an hour in order to harvest. And depending on what organs they are actually taking, right, whether it's corneas or... You know, it's different between that and long bones and so on. The different types of harvesting takes longer. Barb, it's interesting that you bring this up because there's, in Canada right now, there's a pretty hot debate going on about the idea of suicide harvesting, is what they're calling it, on the cheek. The idea is that they're trying to get more organ donors in who are terminal and get them in and actually remove the organs while they're still alive so they're more viable. So, interesting piece. Hopefully you don't go that route. but it's all going to depend on how you die. If you're an organ donor and you've died in a car accident and there's something that's viable and they can get you there fast enough, they will harvest immediately.
If you end up in a hospital from an accident,
yeah,
they're checking that out.
Yeah.
But if you just pass away in your home, family may not know, who do I talk to?
That's right.
Hours before anybody thinks,
right,
you know, it's too late. So I'm wondering, is there a process so I can leave in my paperwork so somebody knows you got to contact these people right now?
That's all that advanced directive material you've got in your freezer and the conversation that you've had with all of those people in your family to let them know that. That's the big thing. You can have all the advanced directives you want, but if you don't tell people in your life who are going to be the ones who find you and say, quick, we got to call so-and-so.
But who are the harvesting people that...
Any urgent care facility is going to know exactly what to do. Yeah. So it would be if someone found you in the process of dying, and you're going to make that call to 911, they're going to ship you to the hospital as fast as they can. If you died at 2 in the morning and they don't find you until 8 in the morning, we've missed our opportunity. So.
Thanks for doing this talk, Lee. I'm looking into creating a green burial cemetery, a conservation method to save a piece of land in Maine, actually, with my partner. And what is the process of doing that like? Have you seen that happen, and is it?
Yeah, this is something I've been deeply involved in for years now, and that's a long conversation you and I need to have. At the moment, I know of about 30 conservation level cemeteries that are trying to get up and running. It's a little more complicated because you do have to have a land trust involved, and that's a relationship building process. But essentially, we've been trying to understand why it's taken so long. In 1998, the first conservation burial cemetery was started at Ramsey Creek in South Carolina, and there are now only maybe, if you're liberal about it, about a dozen conservation level cemeteries in the U.S. And I say you have to be liberal about it because we need those land trusts involved, and a lot of people, it's the last step for them to get that going. But essentially the idea is the concept is a no-brainer. I mean, everybody hears it and goes, well, of course that makes sense. It's just that it's getting the nuts and bolts of it down. In fact, in this October 16th through 18th in Chaska, Minnesota, we're doing our first green burial conference that anyone can come to, and we're getting together all of those people who can answer exactly these kinds of questions, like really in the weeds kinds of questions about this. And I expect as a result of that, we're going to be seeing a proliferation of more green burial space because we're all looking for it. So you and I need to talk more.
First of all, I just wanted to mention that this idea of burying somebody and having that piece of land forever and ever and ever with a stone over that person is very much a cultural thing of the United States, and that where most of the people in this room, where our ancestors came from in Europe, they overturn cemetery space all the time. That's what ossuaries were for. It's where you put the bones after they've decomposed down into bones. You make that grave available to somebody else. So it's very much a cultural construct, this idea of, oh, you only put one person in that hole forever and ever and ever and ever. That's not the way it is in Europe at all, and presumably in other areas where they don't have as much unlimited space as we do. So that idea of conserving that grave is, that's been around for centuries. So that's the first thing. But my question is actually, I am 110% behind this. This is exactly what I want to be buried in, a green burial in a shroud. I'm even optional about the shroud. Just for decency's sake.
We call those the ooh la la burial.
Right. For decency's sake, we'll have the shroud. My husband, not so much. And I'm wondering about what are the gentle, sneaky ways to get family members on board with this?
Yeah.
Or legal.
Well, yeah, but I'm really concerned about family members, and not just for my own burial, but my parents are reaching the end of their lives, and I'm trying to bring them around to this is probably, and they believe that, oh, I want a green burial, I want to be cremated and then scattered in a park. That's their idea of green burial, and I'm trying to make them understand, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
But also my siblings, of bringing my siblings around to, this is really something worth doing. Oh, no, I don't want to touch mom or dad when they're dead. I don't want to have anything to do. How do you work on bringing other people to this?
Well, that would be the story of my life you're talking about here, because I basically do this one person, one room at a time. Advocating for this, and I think it really just comes down to being patient with people about where they are. You know, you're all in the room because you're here. You're mentally and spiritually ready to take on the topic. A lot of people aren't, and you just have to wait for it. I can't give you any magic tricks. I know that normalizing it is really helpful. So when it does come up, you just speak your truth and let it sit there. And eventually something might change that moves their thinking. But yeah, there isn't a lot more you can do than wait for people to be ready. I find that, you know, showing them more literature and showing them that it is more normal, it helps. Because, you know, if they think it's a, you know, a lot of things. When I first started with this work, like 14 years ago, I lost friends over this because they just couldn't understand how I could be thinking or wanting to talk about any of this kind of stuff. I just had to wait and be patient. And now, you know, they come back and go, wow, you're way ahead of me thinking about that. But I had to wait. And back to your other idea, too. It is true. In fact, Germany just changed their timing for reusing a grave from 35 years down to 22. This is happening, and they change things out. In the U.S., though, we have this thing called the rite of sepulcher. And it is it's deeply ingrained in our thinking. And the church... many churches thinking around the value of sacred ground once a body is in it. So this is something else we have to grapple with. Whether we are religious or not, we still have to deal with the legal ramifications of that having become an influence on our law. So that's another big piece of that. Okay.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Again, let's thank Lee for...